Welcome to the latest episode of Global Class, a podcast where we explore the international expansion stories of the world's fastest growing companies and the career journeys of their globally minded leaders. My name is Aaron McDaniel, and I'm here with my co-host, Klaus Vihe.
Thanks, Aaron. In this episode, we're excited to welcome Masami Takahashi. Masami is the CEO of Japan at Miles, an application that offers rewards for traveling, allowing anyone with a smartphone to earn miles and rewards. Whether your commute is by car, rideshare, plane, train, subway, bus, bicycle, or even foot. Prior, Masami led expansion for WeWork and Uber, and he's a perfect example of an entrepreneur, as we've coined in our book, Global Class. In our conversation, Masami shares how to become a bridge between the headquarter and local teams when working on an international market, and why it's important and it's the job of an entrepreneur to help headquarter fall in love with that local market, and how to build trust and strong relationships within a distributed organization, as well as how he helps scale companies like Uber and WeWork into the Japanese market. Let's begin.
Well, Masami, thank you so much for joining us. We are so excited to talk to you. Actually not too long ago in the last few weeks, we first had a chance to talk. And as we went through sharing with you about Global Class and some of our frameworks, you basically showed as a perfect example of this entrepreneur we talked about. I mean, like, if you had to like craft it, like in the dictionary, like the definition is you and your experiences. And so we're so excited to talk to you about your experiences and the companies you've built.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited as well.
Let's go back all the way. So one of the things that Klaus and I realized was that there is these formative experiences that people often have that set them on this path to be interested in global business. And I know you have some unique stories just from childhood and how you grew up. And so let's go all the way back there. Why don't you tell us where you realized that there was a world beyond your backyard?
Sure thing. So I was born in Japan, in Tokyo, Japan. And I spent my first 6 years here. My parents were Japanese. They were born and raised in Japan. It's a very kind of Japanese family. My dad was a journalist with his work in 1988. We moved to London, which is the first experience for any of us to live abroad. This is, 1988, so literally the year the Berlin Wall fell. He was in London kind of covering that out of Europe for a Japanese newspaper. And that's where I first set, got my passport and got on the plane to, explore the world for the first time. Spent 2 years in London without literally knowing more than five words of English. Spent 2 years there. And then we moved to Geneva in 1990. That was actually the year of the first Gulf War. And my father was covering that out of Geneva because the UN was based there and so forth. So I went to an international school there. It was a very kind of diverse community that I actually was a part of. And I think that actually started shaping a little bit of just like how I think about the world and the different types of people that are out there. After that, we came back to Japan for a year. Then I did 4 years in New York in middle school and high school. And then from there, I came back to Japan. So it's literally been back and forth my whole life. Finished high school in Japan. And then I went to college in Chicago. So I went to the University of Chicago and spent 3 years there. And after that, actually, so during the University of Chicago was 9/11. And that was another kind of big event, global event, if you may, that really had an impact on the way what I wanted to do in life. And up until that point, I actually wanted to become a lawyer. With 9/11, I really kind of thought about the types of impact I want to make to the world. Coincidentally, that's when I actually started getting interested in business. I first thought about, going to the UN or the World Bank and trying to help, different people from around the world. But after having talked to a lot of people that are in that space, I actually learned that for better or for worse, there is a lot of, bureaucracy and so forth. And you need a PhD to get into a certain role. And I was like, I actually want to do things quickly. I was very anxious to get out there. And that's where I thought, hey, why don't I actually step foot in the world of business, which is all about quick decision making, about risk taking, about going kind of betting big and making big things happen. That was actually my first. Then when I actually first thought about working in the world of business was kind of late into my college days, and from there I decided that I wanted to move back to Japan because again I'd been going back and forth my whole life, And you know, one of the two companies that I was actually interested in working for at the time was Sony. Sony was a company that really kind of represented the success of Japan, I guess, if you may, post World War II, the rapid, you know, economic growth of Japan and how, you know, it became suddenly became a global business and global brand that people admired. And I love the products. There's a lot of kind of heart and soul of the kind of the engineers and the designers behind the products. And I love the products, basically. So I ended up joining Sony after college. And I spent 4 years at the headquarters in marketing. And from there, I was about to go to business school, but I got an offer actually to work for Sony in France as the product manager of the TV business in France. TVs, I think at that point, represented about 50% of Sony France's business. And I thought, hey, this is, you know, I wanted to learn business. This is great because I spent 4 years at headquarters learning how products are built and designed. And now I'll be kind of in the local market, learning how they're sold to customers and delivered to customers. So I thought I would get kind of the end-to-end spectrum of business by going to France. So I did that, or I went to France, I say, for about 3 years. And from there, I went to business school. I always wanted to go to a school called INSEAD. It was originally from France. They have a campus now in Singapore as well. So it's a one-year MBA program. And I did that. And during INSEAD was 311, which was the big earthquake and tsunami in Japan of 2011. And that was kind of the second really major event in my life that really kind of paved the way to me thinking about what I really wanted to do next. I'd always kind of wanted to use the frameworks of business for social impact. I still remember writing about that for my business school essay. But after 311, I thought, hey, I really want to do something that helps not just to create social impact, quote unquote, but something that really helps my home country of Japan. I remember coming back to Japan for a couple of days over spring break and business school and going up to Fukushima to volunteer and things like that. And I still just remember that there's not a lot of kind of light. And obviously, you know, the electricities had been dimmed and so forth, but just in general, there's just a dark, dooming kind of atmosphere in my home country. And I thought, I really wish I could do something about it and help my home country, which I love. So I had that in my mind. And then that summer, as part of INSEAD, I had my first opportunity to go to Silicon Valley for a class called Building Businesses in Silicon Valley. It was like a one-week boot camp where, you know, every day we would meet different investors and entrepreneurs and you know, successful and not. And they would share their stories and, you know, what made them successful or what they, you know, with the learnings, I guess, from their failures and so forth. It was really, really eye-opening. And I just thought that there was so much that Silicon Valley had to offer in how we could create impact and you know, make innovation happen. So from there, I still remember going to my boss at the time at Sony and said, hey, can you send me to Silicon Valley? I really need to get to Silicon Valley. So long story short, they ended up creating a position for me. And I moved to Silicon Valley after my business school, my one-year business school program. And yeah, I was there for about 2.5 years doing kind of corporate development work for Sony, which is, you know, investment deals, M&A deals, partnership deals, and sourcing different startups and companies that we could work with. Yeah, so that was great. I was, you know, kind of in the heart of things, talking to cutting edge companies and up and rising entrepreneurs and so forth. That was my kind of my first real experience and learning of how startups operate, how they grow, what kind of challenges they face. So I did that for, a little under 3 years. And from there, I got an opportunity to run Uber in Japan. So I came back to Japan in the summer of 2014.
So that's a great foundation for things. So first and foremost, we're reminded of a quote from Marc Benioff, co-founder of Salesforce, about how business can be a great catalyst for change. And, you know, that was kind of one of the strings that you talked about maybe it wasn't that, you know, NGO or government path, but being able to see business as that. The other thing that was particularly interesting from what you said before we get into more questions was that one commonality we've seen amongst a lot of great leaders in their home countries, we'll call it, is this pride for their local market. And how that's one of the key things you want to look for when you're hiring someone, not only a lot of the other ingredients you have in that entrepreneur's mindset, but the fact that there's this pride and desire to build something in your home country and how that can translate to success. And you know, obviously, we'll talk about those successes that you've had in building those businesses there, but that's a great foundation. So the other thing I'm reminded of, Klaus, I don't know if you saw this too, but I was flashing back to conversations from our very first podcast episode with Abe Smith. And it's almost like if this, he's a little older than you, but if this was happening at the same time, you were like crossing each other's paths because he came to Japan to teach English in a tiny Japanese fishing village. And then, you know, and you went to America to learn in the Silicon Valley. And then he actually helped lead a business in London. And, you know, you were living there earlier in your life. So there's all these, you know, crosses to things. But all that said, we referenced this definition of entrepreneurs. And there's this pyramid image we have where there's this entrepreneurial mindset, this company mindset, and this cultural mindset. And, you know, if you look at the different experiences you've had, they each contributed to that. From, in particular, that middle layer, the company mindset within Sony and working in a very established organization, but needing to be an innovator within that, but also having that cultural mindset and taking what is the company culture in Japan and having to figure out how to balance that with the local culture of France and in America, in the San Francisco Bay Area. So maybe talk a little bit about that. And I know there's a lot about the entrepreneur that Klaus wants to ask too. So I'll give it to him after this. But talk about being that balancer between the strong company culture and Japanese business culture of Sony, but then needing to represent that and integrate in the local culture in France and in the US from that experience.
Yeah, that's a really good question. That reminded me of when I first went to France. I guess it's my fifth year in Sony, after having spent 4 years at HQ, thought to myself, what kind of value can I bring to my colleagues at Sony France? How would they view me? And I thought, you know, would they view me almost like as a spy from headquarters that really just wanted to understand what's happening and just kind of take information and report it back? Or, you know, obviously I didn't want to be seen as a spy. Then how could I create unique value so they would, you know, acknowledge and appreciate and respect me for the things I brought to the table. Obviously, I was not fluent. I spoke French, but I was not completely fluent in French at the time. So there were some disadvantages there. So some of it was the cultural elements, just giving them more visibility about the work and the processes that went into building the products that they're selling. Obviously, they have their opinions about the end product. So I was in charge of TV. So the design is this or that, and you know, Sony's is this, but Samsung's is this. And there's always debate and conversation about that, which is, I think, is very healthy. But I think when they start understanding the thought and that has gone into building the products, I think they got more appreciation out of it. You know, it could be like just the color of the bezel of the TV and what inspired them, and you know, bringing those designers to France, because I knew them from my Japan days, getting in front of the designers. And that's where they actually really start feeling the culture and the DNA of the company, the people actually building the products behind the scenes. I think that was something that I was able to do to kind of bridge the two cultures, and something just kind of a little bit eye-opening for them. They've been with Sony France, but they didn't really know Sony HQ in Japan. So I thought that was one thing I did. And another thing, so that was kind of bringing Japan to France. And I also did kind of bringing France to Japan as well, as kind of the almost like the diplomat, where I would, you know, relay a lot of information about France and the European market to Japan, and through the right channels so that the voice is heard. And I could do that because I had unique networks into the right parts, to the right people within the organization, so that when it came to decision-making time, they would come to me for my opinions, or they would take in my opinions and make decisions that way. So then they felt, okay, now we feel really heard by headquarters. And so, you know, when we said that we wanted the bezel to be thinner, or we wanted this to be white instead of black, they actually listened. So that's, in a way, the way I brought value to both sides, to HQ and to Sony France. And I think I just kept figuring out what I could do as kind of the, having kind of wearing both hats almost. I'm from Japan, but working in Sony France, to bring unique value in my initial days.
That's really interesting. You touch on a lot of different topics. You talk about feedback loops, right? Being that local leader that supports communicating the French need to the Japanese market. And in our book, we talk a lot about two-way innovation. And so you addressed a little bit the product changes that they needed in France. But what was some of those insights from the French market that not only, you know, got adjusted for the French market when you changed the product, but also got scaled into other countries as well? Were there some learnings there that actually were applied a little bit more at a global level at Sony, or do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, when a typical engineer and designer think about TVs in Japan, we're talking about 15 years ago or something like that. And they would think about how do we make the coolest looking, the sleekest TVs that have the best image quality. And that was basically the way engineers approach the problem. Like the problem to solve is let's make the best TVs in terms of picture quality and, you know, sleekness in design. But when we went to market, we realized that that's not necessarily what customers are looking for. We first noticed that TVs were getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So as they get bigger, they have this massive black box in the middle of their living room. And oftentimes it's turned off. And it's turned off, it just seems really kind of just a big black box that's really accentuated. So that was one thing. And the other thing is when they turned it on, when it's black, it just seems like a piece of hardware. So one thing one product that actually came out from, you know, numerous visits and market research and so forth was creating a model that was more like a picture frame, where the imagery inside the TV would look like a piece of art, and the surroundings was just like a frame, like a picture frame,
like a nice Monet painting from France.
Exactly, and precisely when we demoed it, that's kind of what we did. We put actually like artwork inside to make it look like a piece of art. And so, you know, that was just one example where I remember there was a lot of discussion around, will this do well? Will it not do well? How should we make it? What should the design be? And it was literally through a lot of visits, not just to like, usually like what we call dealer calls would be going to the equivalents of the Best Buys and the Circuit Cities of the world, of France, I guess, at the time. But we would go to galleries and we'd go to people's homes to really start to understand what, you know, the nuances and how the TVs were being used. And I don't know if that's that answers your question, but that is a product that came out from a lot of the discussions I was engaged in, which then scaled to other markets as well.
Awesome. You talked a little bit about like bringing that visibility to Japan in terms of the French market, right? You being that leader that communicates back home, but how did you approach actually exposing the leadership from Sony to the French market, you know, beyond writing an email? For example, a lot of the challenges that I see with Japanese organizations in Silicon Valley is that these feedback loops doesn't really exist. It's more of a reporting mechanism from Silicon Valley saying, these are the trends that are happening here. And then they take that piece of paper and put it in a stockpile somewhere. How do you effectively bring them over to expose them to that market to realize the importance of actually localizing, you know, aspects of the business for the French market?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I thought about this during my Silicon Valley days as well. In both cases, I was there as an expat. And one of the roles of the expat is to really get people to fall in love with the country that you live in. And it's also to build relationships with the person. That, in my experience, is first and foremost. Once you have that kind of set, when you have built a good relationship and a trusting relationship with that person, when that person coming to visit you really starts to understand and wants to learn more about the country or the culture or the market, that's when their ears kind of open up and are hungry for more information to understand more. When you don't have that, it's literally just like sending a one-way email, which could be treated like spam. Like, I don't want to see this right now. I don't really care for this information. So before sending that information, it's really important to get them excited about you as an individual, and also about what you represent. In my case, it was France and it was Paris. And so I would take them around different places and, you know, wining and dining and all that stuff is actually important because, you know, you have good conversations when they're happening, they open up more, you build that relationship, they start to like the culture, then they're willing to listen. So that kind of feedback loop kind of starts to happen in that way.
I guess a part of it also, I guess, was also exposing them to customers, right? Were there any unique sort of moments where there was an aha experience? As an example, when Airbnb was expanding into Asia, what the team in Asia did was to expose Brian Chesky to users using their app through a one-way mirror. So he actually learned how they're using the technology that they built, right? Were there any sort of unique sort of experiences when they interacted with users or customers that sort of gave them the realization of, okay, hey, we really need to improve our ability to localize the business for the French
market? Yeah, absolutely. We did a lot of research while I was there and behind those kind of magic mirrors as well. I still remember, and these people had no idea that it was Sony or their people from Japan kind of behind those mirrors, but I still remember this one conversation where the focus of the conversation was the remote control, the TV remote control. And they were saying that the TVs are starting to look nicer. There's like LCD TVs and OLED was coming out. It's like, it's looking nice and this and that. But the remote is just, it just looks so cheap and whatever. And I'm embarrassed to have it on my table. So that was actually, when people thought about remote controls in Japan, the most important thing, I think, back then was making the buttons easy to press, especially for like the elderly. As you know, like Japan has an aging population problem and a lot of people watching TV are like, you know, senior citizens. So they wanted to make sure like the usability is high for those people. But when you talk to customers in France that are a little bit younger, that's obviously not what they're looking for. So I remember the idea that came out of it and it was actually productized was that when you're using the remote, you know, you use the remote as is, but when you're not using the remote, when you leave it on the table, you flip it kind of upside down. So think about your smartphone, you like put the screen down and there'd be a button on the backside, you know, kind of like how I think the Pixel phones these days, they have a button on the back, kind of like that. So you have a button on the back of the remote control that allows you to turn the TV on and off. So if you just want to turn it on, you don't need to flip the remote around to turn it on. So that was just one feature, I guess, that came out of a lot of those conversations of people really not liking the remote control and they were not happy with the design and they're embarrassed to keep it on the table. So they're like, okay, let's create a design that makes it enticing for them to keep it on the table, and which was to put a button on the back and make that side look really nice.
So not just the TV, but the remote too. Localize the remote. So before we dig more into your career experience, and for you listeners, we haven't even got to some of the more interesting parts. I want to go back to the mindset that you built over time, especially through your childhood when you know, everything from London to Geneva to Japan to New York to Chicago to all these places. And, you know, I was born and raised in California, and that's where I live now. You know, Klaus is from Denmark and has talked about this global citizenship mindset he has, not even feeling Danish per se. Where do you sit on that? Do you have, you know, not to say you don't have a tie to Japan and you live there now, but what is your viewpoint in terms of the world around you, having lived in all of these different places?
I definitely think, you know, you guys talked about pride earlier. Just because I had been abroad since my younger days, and you know, sometimes I was the only Japanese kid in school or in my class, they would often ask me about Japan. And in a way, I always felt like I was representing Japan. I was like talking about Japan on behalf of the Japanese people to my little class of 20 people. Why this is this way in Japan, you know, why there were so many prime ministers in Japan. Like every year, people would ask me about politics. People would ask me about how does religion work in Japan. They would ask me about Sony and how Sony used to be cool, but what happened? All these things, like over and over again, I would be, you know, in front of a group of people that were just curious to learn about the country of Japan, because I think it is a pretty, in a way, I think it's an exotic, you know, country in different ways. So from that perspective, since I feel like I've had to represent Japan or be the representative of Japan in different circumstances, I think that has kind of culminated to, you know, a sense of pride and love for my home country, but also, you know, view Japan a little bit from the outside because I hear so many different opinions about, you know, non-Japanese people kind of looking into Japan from the outside, how it has viewed and portrayed. So it's like my identity as Japanese, but I think I'm able to observe it almost objectively from the outside as well. So inside out and outside in terms of, you know, the strengths and weaknesses or challenges and opportunities, whatever you want to call it, of my home country. So I obviously feel closest to Japan because, you know, my family is Japanese and I have spent half of my life here. That said, I do understand that there are a lot of opportunities and also kind of challenges that the country faces and the companies here face as well, just because I've been exposed to other worlds and other types of companies.
It's also interesting when you stand in front of people and talk about your home country, you also learn to appreciate it more. As an example, I remember, you know, when I was younger, I think I was around 17. I had nothing to do on that day, but I met two Austrian tourists in the metro in Copenhagen, Denmark, and they looked lost. And I actually ended up showing them around the city the whole day. And I actually learned to appreciate Denmark much more and actually the city much more because they were wowed by these old buildings and all that stuff. And I sort of realized those nuances of my home city that I, you know, usually don't really appreciate when I'm there. So often when you're in your own local environment, you don't really appreciate it on a day-to-day basis. But when you then get these fresh eyes looking at the city, it just changes the way you view things. And just wanted to also address one thing is in terms of the things you shared a little bit earlier about the earthquakes and all that stuff, into the pride and culture and want to go back and contribute. You know, just a week ago or so, there was a shooting in Denmark, Copenhagen, right 5 minutes away from where I grew up. And that sort of pulled me back as well to want to go back and contribute to Denmark and Copenhagen and the families that suffered through this experience. And so I can fully relate to some of the things that you're sharing basically through those experiences, interacting with other people that, you know, want to learn more about the culture, but at the same time also wanted to kind of share that as context so I can completely relate to what you said.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that.
Japan is interesting too, I think in part because of its economic role as, you know, a major economic power for many years, but it's almost singular in its culture if you think about it. Like Canada and US and, you know, North America gets looped together, or Klaus, you know, Scandinavia gets looped together, or Central Europe or Eastern Europe or East Africa and West Africa. But, you know, when it comes to Japan, it's Japan. And so I always found that to be interesting. And you know, we've done a lot of business in Japan and appreciate it a lot. So let's continue on with your journey. So you left us, you know, starting basically as leading the expansion of Uber into Japan. We'd love to start is Uber, like a lot of very successful companies, Uber had a very strong culture. And, you know, Uber is a proxy for any company, but you are leading an organization that has a strong culture away from headquarters. That strong culture doesn't always align perfectly with local culture. You have to make certain decisions. We're going to follow the company on this side. We got to kind of go with the local way on this side, while maintaining that that relationship, being that relay, being that connector you were talking about between HQ. So talk us through how you did that, how you thought about it, because we've interviewed people for Uber for part of our book, and it's like, you know, speed is very much prioritized. There's very strong launch processes set up to go and do things quickly. Love to go back to that time and learn a little more.
Yeah, sure thing. So I joined Uber in the summer of 2014. It's right after they announced their kind of fundraising. And I think they're valued at like $17, $18 billion, which is, you know, a massive deal. Doesn't seem like so big these days, but back in the day, it was like really, really big. And as you might recall, Uber was in the news for different reasons every day. And so it was kind of in the hot seat. But I had the opportunity to I heard through a friend of mine that they're hiring someone to run Japan, and I was intrigued. Obviously, I'd use the service. I was like, okay, this is pretty game changing. I thought it was really, really cool and very kind of clean. The UI I thought was great. I had friends from business school at Uber running different markets, and they seemed to be having a blast. So I said, you know, why not? I talked to them. I think what really fascinated me, just to kind of talk through the process, is the recruiting process. I thought was very good. Very intense. In a way, I think it kind of exemplified the intensity of Uber after you joined. So it kind of got you ready for that. So first it started with like this analytics test, which is basically a 60 or 90 minute Excel test based on Excel. So it's all online and it dumps kind of raw data onto you, and you open that and you kind of have to play through the data and juggle with it to answer questions. Like, if based on the data, and if you could add 50 cars to the road, what day and what hour would you add the cars and why type of thing, right? So you kind of go through those questions. So you do that and you just focus, right? You can't really prepare for this thing. So I did it and I got a call literally like probably like 3 minutes after click send from a recruiter saying, hey, you did really well. So we wanted to do the next thing. And I was like, okay, what's the next thing? And it's like, okay, it's a marketing exercise. And it's like, you know, it's like six, there's six questions and you just have to, you know, do it within, I think it's like 48 hours. And this is like a Friday evening. So I'm like, I had weekend plans, but they're like, no, we really want you to do it within 48 hours. Can you manage? So I was like, all right. So I canceled my weekend plans. I did my marketing exercise and that entailed like creating like a blog post and answering customer tickets as if you were on the ground. And I think one thing that was really, you know, good about that experience was that the more I started working on it, the more excited I got. I could see that I was getting excited about it. I wanted to make it really fancy. And in the end, you know, instead of like just writing the blog post on like on a Word doc, I ended up creating an actual blog and sending them the URL and the password so that it actually almost looks exactly like an Uber blog. And I think they got a kick out of that because they'd never seen that before. It just got me really thinking and creative. I really thought Uber was doing really interesting kind of stunts and you know, Uber ice creams and those types of things. So it got me thinking. I got excited about it. So I sent that and they liked it. And they're like, okay, next last step is we want you to create a business plan. And we want to present it to either Travis or Ryan, who was the COO back then. So either to the CEO, COO, it's like, it'll be 90 minutes. I was like, okay, wow, that's a really long session. It's like, yeah, 60 minutes of presentation and 30 minutes of Q&A. So I basically, and they gave me like 2 weeks. So I basically spent like the next 2 weeks just working on this thing day and night, first understanding, you know, the market in Japan, understanding the laws in Japan, understanding, you know, the customers in Japan, and just thinking through what I could do. And, you know, I think long story short, I put a lot of effort into it. They liked what I presented, but by the end of it, I got really excited about it. I was like, really, I really want to do this. I mean, I think that's actually an important thing for people to kind of jump into these new ventures is like, are they passionate about it? Do they see themselves getting more and more excited as they spend more time on it or not? People that are like, oh, I don't want to do this, or oh, I don't want to put too much effort into it, or I don't have time. Obviously, there's different things in life and maybe it is a really busy period, but I found a way and I just thought, okay, I'm ready. Like when they gave me the offer, I'm like, okay, I'm ready to go. So I jumped in, flew back to Japan and quit Sony. And the next day I was working at Uber. It was a team of three. And as you said, it was, yes, there was a very strong global culture and it's about hustle, it's about speed, it's about executing. It was a team of three back then. So there were two people under me that were already there. I think we had this kind of mix of like, I don't know what the right number is, but maybe like 70% global, 30% local type of mix, where it's like, yes, there is that culture of, you know, hustling and just, you know, working and just being ready and responsive at all hours, but then, you know, and work hard, play hard type of culture, but it wasn't like crazy. So there was that. But as we kind of started building the business, I think internal culture wise, I think that kind of stuck around at least during my days. But when you want to design a business, I think it's a little bit more intricate and sensitive. So it's not just about saying the right things. It's not just about doing things and substantiating what you're doing. It's also about kind of the soft elements of like, again, building the right relationships, showing people respect, courtesy, all those things, you know, are extremely important in a market like Japan. And at that time, I literally had no experience doing this stuff. You know, I barely had a team under me. I'd never, you know, did anything in front of media. I'd never done anything with government officials. I'd never, you know, I was just an employee at Sony Group, which is a massive company. And here I was running this small company in Japan. And there's a lot of, external facing work that I had to do on top of building the operations and the business internally. There was a lot of learnings. And obviously, if I were to go back in time, I think I could probably do a little bit better than I did, you know, 8-9 years ago. But then, you know, that was a definitely a learning experience for me of, you know, executing, getting things done, and trying to replicate what other markets were doing, but in a very Japanese way. And there's some things that worked well and some things that definitely didn't work. So a lot of learnings along the way.
First, for the listeners out there that have a DeLorean, you can go back in time to 2014 and you know exactly how to get a job at Uber, right, during that time. So that was pretty awesome to hear each of those steps that they put you through. You mentioned this a little bit, but I want to dig in a little deeper real quick. So to the point of Uber's culture, right, is you know, very much about speed of going out and doing things. And I think there's different definitions of this, but you know, the whole like ask for forgiveness instead of permission type thing. But that's very different than Japanese culture. And it really wouldn't work very well if you took the full Uber, you know, unfiltered culture and things. And so you did have to create that Japanese filter. Can you talk a little bit more about how you did that balance to localize it, but still, you know, show headquarters that this was the right way to do it, and I'm still fulfilling, you know, the company core values and culture?
So at the time, you know, it was a time of rapid growth for Uber. It was growth, 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 right? We just had to show growth in terms of trips. Trips taken was basically the metric. And it's like trips taken and trips per hour, like how many trips the drivers were doing every hour. Like those are key metrics, obviously, to understand the growth as well as the efficiency of the system. And I think if you could show that, then great. Like that market is thriving. We should pump more money and people into that so that it can grow further. I think in the case of Japan, because the supply side was very challenging to get because of all the regulations and so forth, it was hard to kind of show growth. The efficiency was there because there was, you know, decent demand, but the supply was hard. So it was hard to kind of show trip growth. Literally a month after I joined, we had to announce a new service, which is Uber Taxi. So I was basically kind of looped into this before I joined the company. I was like on these like calls all the time, learning about the service. And you know, that was like my first exposure to kind of, you know, launching a new service. It was small, but we tried and we got, you know, different taxi companies on board and we announced this thing. But you know, it was hard. Uber product wasn't built really for taxis. That wasn't the model. So it was hard it was challenging, I guess, for various reasons. And once we did that, we had the opportunity / I guess mandate to build a product that is more scalable in terms of supply that allowed us to show growth and so forth. And we knew that obviously with the regulations around taxis and so forth, the typical UberX model was very, very challenging, if not impossible in Japan. So we kind of knew that going in. We considered different options of how we would launch that in Japan, but an opportunity came our way and we were basically like almost invited to do a pilot in the city of Fukuoka. That was somewhat of a ride-sharing pilot. It wasn't the typical UberX model. It was a little bit different and we went through different checks to make sure it wasn't, obviously we didn't break any laws or anything like that. But, you know, I think long story short, we launched it and it kind of blew up. I understand it was controversial, but I think if I were to go back in time, I think there's different ways we can launch the same product. Like I mentioned, by kind of being transparent, being upfront, you know, basically kind of showing respect and courtesy to the different stakeholders. And so I definitely think I could have managed that a lot better than I did. But then behind the scenes, as you mentioned, there was a lot of pressure for speed and execution. So we had to launch this thing very, very quickly. So we couldn't take 6 months to go meet all the right people and whatever. We had to do the bare minimum and then launch. That didn't work exactly the way it planned. That was definitely learning. I still feel that what we did back then was appreciated by the users and by the drivers. It was a cool pilot to run. So I know that people would appreciate it if those services existed in Japan. But obviously, in terms of execution, there was room for improvement. So from there, it was about a year or so. It was a little bit, you know, challenging to find kind of the product market fit. How do we kind of fit the Uber model into Japan? We had a lot of inquiries from different municipalities around Japan, which I thought was actually kind of interesting, where the concept of ride sharing was almost like needed in an underserved area. Or areas where there are only seniors living and they're all getting older and they couldn't drive as much as they used to. So they needed ways to get around town. They thought that, you know, the Uber ride sharing model was perfect. So We launched a few pilots with some municipalities in remote areas of Japan, which are actually still running, which I thought that was a very interesting and meaningful use case. You know, it wasn't about trips. I mean, we're talking about municipalities with 50,000 people or 2,000 people. So the number of trips is obviously very, very limited. But the users were actually, they had no other options. They wouldn't be able to go out without a service like this. So I think it was a very meaningful, not a large scale impact, but a meaningful and impactful service from that perspective. So we ended up running a few of those pilots and getting people to understand the value that we could bring through the technology to different people in Japan.
That's it's kind of funny. I had that question next on my list. So I'm going to scratch that off and not ask that question. But it kind of feeds a little bit into another question I have. For example, you know, when you expand to new countries, you often have to adjust your value proposition to that market, right? If you kind of compare with, you know, Uber in San Francisco Bay Area, poor quality and cab service, people always complain, etc. But in Japan, at least from my experience, is neat. You get great customer service. It's reliable, etc. In Latin America, maybe there's a big concern around security when getting transferred from A to B, etc. What was some of the way in which did you guys change the communication to local users in Japan in adjusting the value proposition for that market?
I think that, you know, like you said, there's generally speaking, the, you know, the quality is high and it's clean and they're kind. But I think that there's still quite a bit of variance. And what people in Japan really liked was, for example, the rating system of Uber, of having, you know, also rating the rider as well as the driver. So it's a two-way rating system that Uber has. And people really like that because it's transparent. And also for the drivers, I think they had a higher level of comfort when they got, you know, riders through Uber because they knew what kind of riders would come into their car, for example. So I think that was the transparency of the rating system was something that people really, really appreciated. And yeah, I think that visualizing the experience was also something that was a little bit, it was kind of new, I guess, to Japan, which is traditionally a pretty analog culture where you would call and you would hope for the car to come in 10 minutes or 15 minutes and people being able to see that and being able to anticipate, I think was the user experience I think people really, really liked in Japan. But yeah, in central areas, like in major cities, there's a pretty good abundance of taxis and stuff. So it wasn't the, I can't get anywhere without Uber or I don't feel safe in a traditional taxi type of situation. I think from that perspective, I think the criticality of a service like Uber was probably a little bit lower in a city like Tokyo than, you know, than Mexico City, for example. That said, in some of these underserved areas, this is like a must have. Like people really, really wanted services like this because, again, there are no other alternatives. There was a lot of people that were also willing to be drivers to help transport other people from A to B. So I think both from the supply and demand standpoint, it was a pretty good fit for those areas.
Interesting. So how did that model change then in those underserved areas if you were serving the elderly population? Because I'm assuming maybe this is a bad assumption. You don't have the same economic means. Is it then a partnership with the government where they get reimbursed or anything like that? How did the model change for those more local ecosystems in Japan?
This is pretty, I guess, intricate in the sense that there's a lot of, you know, rules governing, you know, you're not supposed to provide paid transportation unless you're a professional driver and this and that. So, but there are some exceptions. Like I think the government and the laws do understand that in some of these areas, these types of services are required. And it does not make sense for a taxi company to establish their business there because they wouldn't be able to make money. Like there's not enough, there is some demand, but there's not enough demand to pay for a full-time driver. So there are some of these exceptions and we leveraged those. We had, you know, we inked MOUs with different cities and towns around Japan. I don't know how many I did, but probably 6 or 7 different municipalities that we signed MOUs with. And we would go into the market, try to understand, you know, what areas have the biggest needs. We launched a couple of different variations of the service in these remote areas. But yeah, we were looking just for ways as a proof of concept to show that the Uber model could deliver value in unique ways that other services couldn't.
And so then after you built out Uber in Japan, you just decided to retire, right?
So I wish.
So Uber wasn't it, right? For your encore, why don't you tell everyone where you went next and what happened? Because from one big global brand to the next in terms of fast growing company?
Yeah, yeah. So just to finish off, I guess my Uber story, the latter half was launching Uber Eats in Tokyo. So that got off to a really, really good start. Japan is like the mecca of food, you know, the most Michelin star restaurants, I guess, you know, globally. So a lot of good restaurants and people love food here. So Uber Eats business took off in a massive way. And I think it's grown tremendously since as well. So that was kind of the latter half of, you know, the first half was trying to find product market fit. And the second half was really like scaling a service. So that was kind of two unique experiences at Uber. So I was there for a little under 4 years. I was starting to think about what next. That's when the opportunity came to kind of join the Japan launch of WeWork. That was also a very unique experience in itself. You know, I guess Uber and WeWork have since both become TV series. You know, it's like I got to
experience. You're not a character in either episode, are you, when they go to Japan?
No, not that I know. But yeah, so it was a very, from an experience standpoint, it was a very like no other experience I think I had in both those environments. There were definitely commonalities, a lot of differences as well. I think the commonalities is, again, I think growth is a key word in both companies, where it's all about how do you scale quickly and how do you execute and how do you scale and how do you do it quickly. So it's the same for WeWork, except the difference at WeWork was that because there's a lot of hardware, meaning like buildings and stuff, there's a lot of kind of lead time that's required to launch the business. Whereas Uber is more of a digital product that you can kind of expand into a new city. As long as you had drivers there, you could expand quickly. WeWork required a lot of planning. We had to get supply was also hard for WeWork because we had to find the right buildings. We had to, you know, negotiate with the landlords and to find the right building in the right place for the right price was definitely not easy, especially in Tokyo's real estate market where occupancy was very high. So the vacancy of the building types of buildings we wanted to get into were very low. So, you know, that was, I guess, one of the unique challenges at WeWork. But there's definitely a focus and emphasis on scaling the business very quickly. So, yeah, and that required not only just investments, but also people. So WeWork was a different level, I guess, from that perspective. I think we hired probably close to 200 people in the first year or two, like literally. You know, some days I would be, you know, meeting 70 candidates a day, trying to find the right person. And, you know, we're all pressed for time because we know the openings of different buildings were happening. So we needed staff to run those buildings and A, B, and C. So it was a constant kind of struggle of finding the right people, but quickly and securing buildings. And so it was like doing everything all at once type of craziness. It was fascinating, but a very, very busy and intense time of my career.
So that's really interesting. Hiring 200 people in 1 year, right? And needing to be mindful of that give and take we were talking about between fitting into company culture that WeWork had, another company with very strong company culture, but also having that local market knowledge and blending those together. Talk about that whole team building process, what you looked for in terms of traits, who you saw, and not that you didn't hire an Uber, right? You did, but like, to that scale so quickly and the physicality of the product, like you were saying with WeWork. Talk about how you went about building that team, how you thought about it, the types of people you looked for.
That's a really good question. I think the types of people we hired at WeWork are a little bit more diverse than at Uber. Uber was like, we needed really strong operators to operate the business. We required operators, but there's also kind of more hospitality people that we needed, people with hospitality mindsets that were there to serve our members at the different buildings. So that was a very kind of different type of profile that we had to look for, which is also a little bit new to me. So I took the guidance of my boss, who was the CEO of Japan and former CEO of Global. So he's kind of seen it all. And so I took his cues and I learned a lot from him about the types of people we hired. But I think one of the uniquenesses of the people we hired, as well as hence the service we provided, was that because it is a kind of human to human interaction business where our members would come to the office every day and they would use our services, they would meet the team and interact with the staff. The human touch was extremely important for a service like WeWork. And we made it a thing to not make it, to localize it too much to Japan, especially in the early days. We wanted to see how much of the kind of the ethos of WeWork Global we can maintain in Japan, because we knew that it was something new, we knew that it was something that people were curious about. They wanted to experience what it was like to work in a WeWork, the types of WeWork you would see in New York or San Francisco. So yes, we did do, you know, a bunch of localizations and so forth, but that was, I think, we knew that users' expectations would be very high. So the bars were set very high. But in terms of the culture and the vibe that we wanted to kind of bring to the WeWork locations, we tried really hard to kind of keep that fairly consistent with the rest of the world.
It's kind of interesting. I kind of reflect back on when I visited a WeWork space in Japan, and there's definitely a lot more suits than casual wear as compared to San Francisco Bay Area. So I guess to that question about the vibe, did you feel like did you get there an 80% in terms of in Japan, getting the San Francisco type of vibe to the Japanese market, or what's your thought about that?
That was actually what a lot of our members mentioned as well. But I think we probably maintained 80-85% of what was happening globally. And I think that the members, meaning the users of WeWork, started assimilating to what WeWork is offering. So they started feeling almost out of place coming to a WeWork in a suit. So, you know, there were some members I talked to and they were like, no, we actually stopped wearing suits. We made a thing not to wear suits because that's not the types of people we wanted to be anymore. And so that was really interesting that people started kind of, you know, themselves realizing, you know, how they wanted to be and how they wanted to express themselves was changing given the change in the environment. And I think that is one thing that WeWork was able to bring to Japan, was just getting people to think a little bit differently, interact with the types of people that they wouldn't interact with in their corporate office. And that might be, you know, foreign startups coming to Japan. It might be, you know, younger Japanese startups. It might be people from completely different industries. But that kind of mixed bag of different people, I think, was a unique offering that WeWork was able to bring.
So it's not just technology you brought back to Japan. It's also a different vibe, different type of business culture as well that sort of impacted the Japanese business environment ecosystem.
That's right. That's right.
I want to kind of go into the last phase, not the last phase of your career, because you still have a lot of years ahead of you, but in terms of where you are right now. But I'm particularly interested in understanding how the learnings from previous roles, like WeWork, Uber, even Sony, is sort of culminating in the role that you have at Miles Japan right now. Can you talk a little bit about some of those experiences from the past make you an even better leader taking Miles into the Japanese market?
So where I'm now is I have, you know, after spending about 7 years or so in these kind of hyper growth companies, Uber and WeWork, I took on a role to run basically an open innovation arm of a venture capital based out of San Francisco called Scrum Ventures. So I run kind of the business incubation, open innovation arm of it called Scrum Studio. And what we do is basically we bring together global startups and Japanese corporates and try to bring them together to build new businesses together. So that's kind of the concept behind what we do. So a lot of it is, you know, understanding what the big corporates in Japan want to do. And based on that, we source the best startups in the world that are capable of doing those things. And we bring them together and help them develop new businesses. And as part of that, the first kind of incubation project we took on was to bring a company called Miles into Japan. So Miles is a early stage startup based out of Redwood City in California, and you know, it launched in the U.S. 3 or 4 years back. It's basically a smartphone app that rewards all travel with miles. So for all your daily travels, whether it be walking, running, biking, taking a train, you would earn miles from that automatically. So that was the concept of Miles. We brought it to market last year. So we launched in October of last year. And in order to do so, we basically, through the Scrum network, we kind of brought it together with, you know, very large kind of Japanese well-known established companies like Japan Airlines, like Family Mart and others. So we had a lot of good kind of reward partners on the platform when we launched. And so we got off to a really, really good start launching that service. But, you know, I think that was interesting because after having spent the first half of my career at a Japanese corporate and the second kind of half, I guess, at these startups, I felt like I could really be the bridge between corporates and startups, Japanese companies and foreign companies, and be that bridge and really to be kind of the mediator in the middle or the facilitator to communicate both ways what we're trying to accomplish, which oftentimes are not that far apart. They kind of, because of the barriers in communication and so forth, oftentimes, you know, many people, both on the startup and corporate side, find it challenging to really communicate with each other. But I think, you know, what I've been trying to do is to leverage my background and my experiences to be that, I guess, that middle person, to be that bridge and to, you know, facilitate the conversations and to get people excited to do something really meaningful and fun together. I mean, I think, you know, to a certain extent, we're able to do that with the Miles launch in Japan.
That actually ties perfectly with the question I had, the piece of advice that you're very uniquely qualified to talk about, which is, you know, what are those keys to success for being away from headquarters, but being able to be that bridge, especially, and, you know, one of the things you said earlier, when you were at Sony, you had network that you were able to call on to help facilitate that bridge. But because it was so new and things were growing so fast, it didn't really exist when you were at Uber. It didn't really exist when you were at WeWork because you were there from the beginning, right? And you were living in Japan. You hadn't worked at headquarters for a couple of years like you had with Sony. But so what are those keys to success that people who are in those type of roles away from headquarters, and especially when you don't have that network, what is the best way to go about being that bridge and building that?
So I think, you know, the first thing that I think is really important is to kind of build a sense of trust within the company, which again was not easy, especially in my role at Miles, because it was COVID. And to this day, I've still never met the CEO of Miles, who's based out of Redwood City. So I've still never met him. We talk almost every day these days, but we've never met. But building that trust kind of both ways, initially, and understanding how we think and what we value and the types of questions we both ask, I think shows a lot about the level of curiosity, the level of understanding. So I think that's been really, really important, kind of build that as a foundation. And from there, I think kind of frequent, no, it could be light touch, but communication, I think, is important so that people, you know, at HQ, for example, just have a sense of what's happening all the time. You don't need to send super long emails or whatever. I actually would advise not to do that, but just snippets of information which you think is relevant, which you think is interesting, which you think is, you know, funny or cool or challenging. Just sharing that in live form, I think, has been important to, you know, keep building on that level of trust that you build with HQ. So I think frequency, transparency, asking questions, answering first. So you don't want to ramble on about different things. Obviously, they're asking you a question for, you know, because they want to know something. So answer first and answer succinctly, and then give them background as necessary. All those things, kind of a lot of the communication, I think, is really key to build that kind of relationship with HQ, especially when you join your organizations.
You touched upon a lot of the principles that we discuss in the book. We have what we call four commitments, and you basically touch them on, you know, most of them there, three out of four right now. So we're completely aligned and bought into what you're saying. As we have talked to a lot of business leaders, a lot of people leading expansion, they always say Japan is one of the hardest markets to go into and expand to. And since you have, I guess, very much the experience of leading the expansion for tech companies in Silicon Valley, entering to Japan, I wanted to also learn from you a little bit about the things that companies should think about when expanding to Japan, as well as also what are the specific things that you would recommend them to do to set them up for success? Because there's a lot of challenges when it comes to that journey.
I mean, one thing they could do is contact us and we can help their Japan entry.
True.
jokes aside, I think every market is unique. And I hear this a lot, and I think there's truth to all of them, right? Our country is unique, and so is ours. So is ours. Japan is also very unique. It is very unique. Some of the things that really make it unique are, I think, the presence and the influence that large corporations have in Japan are probably a little bit larger than other countries. And I think that's partly because the startup ecosystem also hasn't been built out as much as places like the US or Europe even. So finding ways to leverage some of those large players in Japan can really open up a lot of doors for you. So I think that is probably one of the biggest differences in terms of doing business development in Japan. And post-launch, you know, one thing that we have learned firsthand at Miles is like the influence of media, especially TV in Japan, is massive. And that's also because there's only like five or six kind of major networks in Japan that 90-95% of the population watches. So it, getting airtime on those can really kind of expand your business in pretty big ways. And we saw that firsthand with like the growth, the user growth that we saw when Miles is covered in you know, some of these major shows. It's like, wow, like it's like going through the roof type of thing. So thinking that was something that was unique. And so I think from that perspective, finding a partner that you can work with to A, put you in touch with the right people and the right companies. It's not just the companies, it's like who within the company can move the needle was, I think, is very important for people to consider. And I think crafting a story with those companies so that media could be, you know, interested in covering. Like if you're like a no-name startup coming into Japan and you have a cool product, but you just have a cool product, it's really hard for people to write about or people to, you know, to host in their show. But if you have associations with, you know, these major Japanese companies, that gives them an angle to, you know, and that people that can, and people will be able to kind of understand and appreciate and associate themselves with these larger companies. I think that has been very useful when, you know, especially when launching Miles this time around in Japan.
Totally. And I remember DocuSign as well. Part of what they did was to partner with a local company called Shachihata, a hango stand maker, to associate themselves with that company. But they also created a local advisory board of large Japanese corporations as well. So they kind of built that affiliation to the market, but also to kind of to describe a little bit how big sort of important corporates are in Japan. And this is a little bit of a dated number, but I believe it was around 60% of invested capital was coming from corporates in Japan, at least a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. Probably changed a little bit, right? But certainly very, very prevalent there. Having said that, Masami-san, let's move into the final segment of today's podcast, three pieces of advice. Are you ready for the three questions?
Let's do it.
Awesome. Okay. What one piece of advice would you give to someone interested in building a career around international business?
I would say putting yourself in an environment where you can really get your hands dirty.
Awesome. What one piece of advice do you have for a business leader expanding a business to new markets?
Be on the ground, meet people, and build relationships with people on the ground. Spend less time on Google, but really talk to people and have them introduce you to more people for you to get a holistic understanding of the market.
I guess this is the piece of advice to the young guy that was thinking about being a lawyer or going to the UN. What one piece of advice do you have for your younger self?
Follow your passion. I think that in a certain regard, that your passion can change, or the passion could be the same, but how you pursue it might change. But following that passion to me has been always very important. I think I have done that in my career, but I've never really thought about it from that perspective when I was younger. But I think that's probably what I would tell my younger self.
Masami-san, thank you so much. There are so many great things that you talked about, from the importance of having pride for your local market and that passion and excitement you just keyed in on, how to be that bridge between, you know, the local office and headquarters, and how to expose each side to what's happening to really, you know, build that bond and understanding, how to build a sense of trust and strong communication. Some great insights about doing business in Japan and in particular tying into large corporates within that ecosystem and the importance of relationships and of course how to get a job at Uber in 2014 for those who want to go back in time. So thank you so much. It was really great to talk to you.
No, thank you so much for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Thanks, Masami-san.